Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 6th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Rapture in Reverse, Reading the Book of Revelation So the Earth is Not Left Behind, presented by Barbara Rossing. The number is ROB2002-04. Let's listen in.
And I'm one of the summer teaching staff coordinators, and I fill in a lot of times on Saturdays with Bible studies after the regular teacher has finished. So today we're going to have a one-session look at the Book of Revelation, sort of through the lens of this recent set of novels. I've got three of them here. My husband just gave me two for my birthday, but he assures me that he bought them at a used bookstore. this recent series called Left Behind by Tim LaHaye and Terry Jenkins that I will say right off, I have significant problems with this whole rapture chronology, and that's partly what I want to talk about today, although the Book of Revelation in general, too, so if you want to pick up a Bible, that'd be great. This sort of came to our national forefront a little more with this cover story on Time Magazine. It looks like you've got it, too, do you? Yeah. The Bible and the Apocalypse. Why more Americans are reading and talking about the end of the world. And just sort of the juxtaposition of these headlines, I want to talk with you today about what I think the apocalypse means. The Book of Revelation is called the Apocalypse. That's the word in Greek. The first word in the Book of Revelation is apocalypse, apocalypsis. And so that's often translated as revelation. That's why we call it revelation. But some, I think especially Roman Catholics will call this book the Apocalypse of John. And I want to talk about why I don't think the main purpose of the Book of Revelation is to teach about the end of the world. So obviously I'm going very much against this set of novels. But I want to talk about it because this, as the announcement at breakfast said, I just got a nice big grant to write a book on this topic. And I'm going to spend next year on sabbatical trying to write a book that will be readable, not like my other book, which was my dissertation that went out of print after 2 years. Which is how dissertations do. I mean, you're lucky to even get a dissertation published. But anyway, that one was fairly unreadable with millions of footnotes and Greek words and stuff. But what I want to try to do, and it is on the Book of Revelation. I think I gave a copy to the Holden Library, so it's in there if you want it. But what I want to try to do today and then in this book is get your ideas about what would speak to this phenomenon. What's the tremendous attraction of this series of novels? It's not particularly high-level fiction, although the stories are gripping, and they read much like a sort of disaster novel in some ways. But what is it that is so compelling, especially now after 9/11, that's the thesis of this article, about this kind of perspective on the Bible, on the Book of Revelation? Why are people so interested in the end of the world and then in looking for biblical texts that seem to play into that, although I do want to walk you through them and show that I don't think that's what the biblical texts say at all. But I thought I would begin by playing for you a little clip from the movie Left Behind. As far as I know, the second movie is not out yet, although it will be out soon. I'll just read you some of the statistics here on this. There are now 10 novels. And maybe it's 11, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. No, 10. And together they've sold more than 50 million copies. And there's not only the novels, but there's youth versions of them. There's a website. There's board games. There's playing cards. There's everything. This is a huge industry. And when the books come out in hardcover, they're over $20 a piece. Then when they come out in paperback, I think they're like $14.95, but they are not cheap. And this is an enormous multi-million dollar industry, this Left Behind series. This first movie, Left Behind, I think came out 2 years ago. And, I'll show you a clip of it. You'll see Kirk Cameron is the only star whose name you would know. And I didn't know that one, of course, because I'm an academic. But he's in there, and he plays Buck Williams, the journalist. We're going to start sort of in mid-movie. And what I'm skipping over is he's already uncovered a sort of plot having to do with Middle East prophecies taking place in Israel. And I guess that's another aspect of this series of novels that I think we really have to critique as Christians is the way this is playing out even in our own nation's politics about issues on the Middle East. A very strong pro-Israeli stance, thinking that the aggrandizement of Israel must take place as part of fulfillment of biblical prophecy. And I think we have to really talk about that as Christians, since there are other Christians living in the Middle East, Palestinian Arab Christians, for whom this kind of interpretation is not only troubling but dangerous, because they are losing their land and losing their lives. So I think the way these novels play into Middle East politics also, and the whole history of the American prophecy movement and how that has had a political impact is very serious for us too. But I'll show you this little clip. This is on an airplane flight. The pilot, Rayford Steele, has left his son's birthday party to go take off to fly transatlantic. I think he's flying to London or something. And he and his wife have had a fight because she's gotten more and more involved in their Bible church and goes to all kinds of midweek stuff, and the son also. And Rayford Steele is somewhat skeptical. He's a baptized Christian and stuff, but he doesn't want to go to church as much as she does, and he's not as much a fundamentalist. So they had this fight before taking off, and now he's flying across the Atlantic. And he seems to be having a little, the lead flight attendant, Hattie Durham, wants to have an affair with him. So they're in the galley where Hattie's going to say, you know, this is it, Rayford, if you won't, you know, run off with me, I'm leaving you. Okay. And then when it starts, the fluorescent light is the one over there, but not those dots, but the one to the right of that, there. And so after I start, you can turn that off, because I know there's not a real strong image here. If I got this correct. I'm not a very good technical person.
You're an academic.
Oh, wait. Oh, I goofed it up. Sorry. Oh, darn it. Is it doing anything?
No.
Okay. Oh, here. The next light, then the round ones, too. Oh, there's no sound.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, there's sound.
They're kissing.
It's just kissing sound.
Where are you? Yeah. Is everything okay?
It's my husband. He's disappeared.
You know what? I bet he just slipped off to the restroom while you were asleep.
Would you mind checking, please? Take this,
ma'am.
I think he's gone off naked.
Gone.
Take it easy. Just take it easy, okay? You're gonna be all right.
What's going on, Captain?
To be in the position of those parents whose kids are taken and the parents are left behind. I mean, that's the very strong appeal is this, is it plays on our fears of being left behind, and no one wants to be left behind. Rayford will
want to get taken.
Okay. Theology comes from, it's a pastiche of several texts. The Matthew 24 one, it's not based on, strictly on the book of Revelation at all. In fact, I'm going to argue that it's the opposite of the book of Revelation, but they put together a number of texts. Some of the tribulation stuff from Revelation, and you do in Revelation have this 7 years of tribulation stuff, but there's nothing about the snatching or the taking. They put that together with a passage in 1 Thessalonians that we'll look at. And then in Matthew 24, 41. Oh, I'm going to have the markers wrapped in here. Matthew 24:41 has this passage, two women will be in the field, one will be taken, one will be left. That's where this idea is coming from. But it's interesting, as you look at the Gospel of Matthew as a whole, I mean, not just proof text and specific verses, it's not clear whether the good thing is to be taken or the good thing is to be left. It's not at all clear. Whereas the premise, obviously, of the Left Behind movies is that you want to be taken. True Christians want to be taken. Because, indeed, what happens then in the next seven novels is they will argue this is the beginning then of the seven-year period of tribulation and disasters come to the earth. I mean, it plays out like one disaster movie after another. And the idea is you don't want to be left behind. But I would agree with you. If you look at the scriptures as a whole and at the specific gospel passages that have this one taken, one left idea, it's really unclear which is to be desired, being taken or being left. That's one problem with it. Other reactions to the movie? Well, how many have heard about the notion of the rapture? Yeah, it's very widespread. And it's interesting. This is, let me just say a little background about this. This theology of the rapture was not part of early Christianity at all. In fact, the word rapture is not found anywhere in the Bible. Hal Lindsey, in his book, The Rapture, argues that it's based on the Latin translation, raptio, of the word that is used in 1 Thessalonians 4. And maybe you want to look at that text with me. Let's see. We used to be able to call out the page numbers in the Bibles, but maybe somebody who finds it in one of the black Bibles, tell us what page that's on.
1030.
Okay, 1030. Okay, in 1 Thessalonians 4, this is Paul's very first letter. And he's writing to the community in Thessalonica that he had to leave. He seems to have been driven out of town for some reason. And this is his very first Christian letter to a Christian community, we think. And apparently the Thessalonians have either written to him or sent word to him saying, you say that Jesus is going to return, yet some members of our families or our communities have died. What about them? What's going to happen to the ones who have died? And so Paul writes back in a very pastoral fashion saying, don't worry, we'll all be together. So it's sort of the opposite of the Left Behind. It's not that families will be split and some will be left behind. Rather, Paul writes to assure them, if you look at 1 Thessalonians 4, 16 and following, or 15, we declare this to you by the word of the Lord that we who are alive, who are left until the coming of the Lord, shall not precede those who have fallen asleep. Precede those who have fallen asleep. For the Lord himself will descend from heaven with the cry of command, with the archangel's call, with the sound of the trumpet. The dead in Christ will rise first. Then we who are alive, who are left, shall be caught up together with them in the air to meet the Lord in the air. And so we shall always be with the Lord. Therefore, comfort one another with these words. It's that word caught up in verse 17. Harpagesomatha, here it is, in the clouds, is the Greek word. And Hal Lindsey argues that the Latin then could be rendered in English as this word rapture, which he and others made up to describe the supposed snatching up into the air phenomenon. But notice, when this is the only time Paul talks about it. I mean, some will argue that Paul's talking about it in 1 Corinthians 15, but I don't agree with that. That chapter is about the resurrection. This is the only time Paul talks about it. And notice, his whole purpose here is to say that we'll be together. No one is going to be left behind. Your relatives who died are not going to be left behind. You know, and he's saying comfort one another with these words. But that's where the word in English rapture came from. And it's interesting. It's a highly American phenomenon. The word rapture doesn't exist in other languages either. And as I say, it's not in the Bible. So it developed in the 1840s when American prairie populists brought over some of the ideas of a British guy named Darby, Charles Darby, and then it came into this movement that later became the Jehovah's Witnesses and the Seventh-day Adventists, the Millerite movement, and has always been strong in the United States in the last 150 years, but is a relatively new phenomenon. And then it was made especially popular here in the United States in the 1970s by Hal Lindsey, his book, Late Great Planet Earth, and then many others. And as it's interesting, as this cover story in Time points out, it didn't, talking about the Hal Lindsey phenomenon, it never seemed to hurt that Lindsey's predictions passed their, quote, sell-by date. You know, that the dates would pass. That the things he predicted did not take place when he said they would, but it never seemed to hurt. During the Gulf War, sales of his book jumped 83% as people feared that Saddam Hussein was rebuilding Babylon and dragging the world into its last battles. Nowadays, Lindsey sees his early warnings being vindicated almost daily. The Muslim terrorists are going to strike the U.S. again and strike us so hard, it's not far off. So this so-called prophecy movement is hugely popular in the United States, and I would say especially among young people. And that, I guess, is one thing I want to talk with you about. I remember myself when I was in college during the Hal Lindsey days, and I was going every Sunday to the Lutheran church. Well, not every Sunday, but, you know. Fairly often to the Lutheran church, my home Lutheran church. I couldn't have been more anchored. I mean, I went to college in my hometown, north of Minnesota. I went to St. John's Lutheran Church. Yet still, at Carleton College, where I was a student, the Campus Crusade for Christ group was barraging me with these messages. You're going to be left behind. You're going to hell. You're not a true Christian. And you need to believe this stuff, or else God doesn't love you. And it's a powerful draw on a young person, this sense of fear. As you saw, the playing on people's fears. You know, a family's worst fear is to not be able to find your child, right? And in this rapture theology, in these books, every child under the age of 12 was missing. There were no more children, because the idea is that children are somehow pure. And so they all got snatched up. Okay. Oh, you talk about that one. And so families are missing their children. And the message then is that if you don't want to have your kids taken away from you and snatched up to be with Jesus, then you need to shape up your life and become a born-again fundamentalist Christian so that this won't happen to you. And it's very much a kind of fear-based theology. In my opinion, it's also escapist. And I think that's why I put in the title, Reading Revelation So the Earth is Not Left Behind. I think it promotes this notion, and certainly not all fundamentalist Christians have this by any means, but some have. For example, in the first Reagan administration, in the 1980s, the Secretary of Interior, James Watt, was a fundamentalist Christian, and went on record as saying, and it's a paraphrase, I don't have the exact quote here, but you can read it in a book in the library called When Time Shall Be No More, Prophecy, Belief in American Culture by a historian at the University of Wisconsin, Paul Boyer. He's got the exact quote. But anyway, James Watt said, might as well chop down the trees anyway and use it all up because Jesus is coming soon. And I think that's a very dangerous sort of theology of, you know, might as well trash the planet Earth because my true home as a Christian is up in heaven. And I'm going to be snatched up there to be with Jesus in heaven. And we're going to sort of watch from up there as the world disintegrates. And the kind of theology of what's going to happen to Earth and even what the Bible prophesies as being what God is going to unleash on the Earth is very destructive. And appalling, so that suddenly then it becomes the explanation for wars, for nuclear disasters, for environmental disasters. But the idea is that God will snatch the elect up into heaven. And indeed, there's a quote that I used in one of the recent articles that I wrote for a thing called the Earth Bible Series that's coming out soon. We've got a couple volumes in our bookstore on the Old Testament, but I'm writing the New Testament one. And Hal Lindsey says very clearly, I'm not so worried about environmental destruction because I know that I've got a home in heaven with God, and earth is not my home.
It sounds like a way for not having to take responsibility for any kind of action in your life. All you have to do is just have some kind of magic words that you say that makes you this kind of certain kind of Christian, and then you don't have to take responsibility for anything.
Well, actually, most do take responsibility. I mean, they do. They believe the responsibility wouldn't be so ecological or citizenship oriented or whatever, but it would be very much
saving everybody else.
And yeah,
getting everybody on the train. So we
and being faithful. The series takes a very strong anti-abortion tack. For example, Hattie Durham, the flight attendant, when Rayford Steele. He lands the plane, and then all is chaos in O'Hare in Chicago. It's interesting. They call around to all the different places to see where they can land, and the only place that has enough air traffic control is Chicago. So they land the plane, and then he goes home. Makes his way home and goes to their house and pulls back the covers in the bed and finds his wife's nanny there and stuff and cries over a picture and stuff like that. Realizes then what's happened. Plus he goes to her church, and the pastor has left behind a video saying, if you're watching this video and I'm not here, that means the rapture has happened. And here's the biblical prophecies that it's fulfilling. And so Rayford Steele does get born again. And Hattie comes over to his house and tries to get him to go off with her, but he won't.
Isn't it too late?
No, because...
Did it happen again?
Well, no, because... here.
It's not too late.
No. There's... I am going to have to get these magic markers working. But anyway, no. In the fundamentalist chronology, the idea is there's going to be this 7-year in the timeline. Here's now. Then there's going to be the 7-year period.
Tribulation.
I can't even spell year here. Tribulation. And then comes the 1,000-year reign of Christ when Christ returns to earth. And then comes the end of the world. They have a whole timetable kind of laid out. And these are all what you would call premillennialists. They literally believe in a literal millennium, and that something's going to happen premillennialist. But the premillennials don't agree on whether the rapture comes before the 7-year period of tribulation or after the 7-year period of tribulation or during. So you've got fights among the premillennialists, and it's interesting, in Hal Lindsey's book, The Rapture, he's very much critiquing the post-tribulation rapture premillennialist, because he's a pre-tribulation rapture premillennialist. And so are LaHaye and Jenkins. In other words, the rapture happens before, as a pre-tribulation. The rapture, well, let's draw it like this. The rapture would happen there, before the tribulation. But they have a dose of post-tribulation rapture premillennialism, in the sense that the people who convert during the time of the tribulations, like Rayford Steele, Buck Williams also converts, and he ends up, I'm not sure if he gets married to Zoe, but he and Zoe are boyfriend-girlfriend, Zoe the daughter, you know. And Hattie, because Rayford won't sleep with her, she ends up marrying the Antichrist. No, not marrying him. This Romanian guy named Nicolae Carpathia, I think is his name, gets involved with Hattie Durham, the lead flight attendant, and gets her pregnant and stuff. So then the whole question of abortion comes up, too. And it's very involved. But anyway, the idea is that this little band of people, which then consists of Buck Williams, Rayford Steele, Zoe, and a few others, the ones who become true Christians during the tribulations, they become the tribulation force, and they have to combat evil and last through the 7 years. But there is going to be another chance to get taken at the end of the rapture, or at the end of the tribulation. So it's that sort of combination. And there are a number of fundamentalists who are post-tribulation rapture. So they have to work in that theology. Uh-huh.
Well, Where does Armageddon fit in this?
Okay, that is in Revelation. And I should say much of the imagery of these books is from Revelation. Revelation, and I work a lot on this book. When you read it, and most Lutherans don't read it, by the way, we could just say that, find it terrifying. And then you're in the great tradition of Martin Luther, who also didn't think too much of this book. But as you read Revelation, it does have violent imagery in it, and becomes then pretty good fodder for these novels, although I don't think that's what the book of Revelation is about. Let's see, Armageddon, I think, is at the end of... boy, I should know this, shouldn't I? 13? That's where you get the number 666, is at the end of chapter 13. I think Armageddon is right at the end of chapter 16. Yeah, 16:16. So many of the words that you find in these disaster and end times novels, and many of the disasters, the idea of the seven seals, the seven plagues, the bowls, the trumpets, that kind of stuff, is in Revelation. Yeah. So this is at the end of the pouring of the sixth bowl in Revelation 16:16. They assemble at the place which is called in Hebrew Armageddon, and then the seventh bowl. And then comes the judgment on Babylon in Revelation. Beginning in chapter 17, Babylon is introduced first as this harlot and then as a city. Now, I guess I could just say in a nutshell, in my opinion, that's what the book of Revelation is about. Babylon is the Roman Empire. You can see that in chapter 17 when she's introduced, 17:1. Come, I will show you the judgment of the great harlot. She has committed fornication with the kings of the earth. On her forehead, in verse 5, is written the name Babylon, the great mother of harlots. And at the end of chapter 17, verse 18, the woman that you saw is the great city which has dominions over the kings of the earth. So the harlot of Babylon, then, is the great city, Rome. And you know it's Rome because back in 17... Anyway, she's seated on seven hills. Oh. Well, there were, 17:9. The seven heads on the beast. She's seated on this seven-headed, ten-horned beast. And now it's saying the seven heads on the seven beasts are the seven hills. Rome was the only city in the ancient world which was known to have seven hills. I'm now told that Seattle has seven hills. There was no Seattle at the time when Revelation was written. So,
what's the Greek word for Starbucks?
Yeah, what's the actually, there are stars in Revelation. So, in my opinion, and most scholars' opinion, the book of Revelation is written as a critique of the Roman Empire, of Rome, both the city and the empire, because you notice it says Babylon is a great city, but it's also fornicated or had commerce with all the nations of the earth, and fornication in the Old Testament is a metaphor for trade and commerce and idolatry, and Rome is being accused of all these things. So Armageddon, then, is going to be Rome's defeat, essentially. The book of Revelation, I think, is not so much about the end of the world as it is about the end of Rome. John, the author of the book of Revelation, is very concerned about what he sees as Rome's injustices and its idolatries. And maybe not outright persecutions. We don't know that Christians were being killed at this time, but they had been killed at 30 years earlier at the time of Nero. John had likely witnessed the terrible Jewish war, and every time I travel, I was just in Rome a couple months ago, and go and see, how many of you have been to Rome and seen the Arch of Titus? Have some of you? Or you've probably seen pictures of it. I mean, this is in the Roman Forum. The whole thing leads up to these triumphal arches that every time Rome won a major military victory, they would set up these arches as propaganda, as they did on their coins, to advertise the fact that they had conquered the whole world. The land of Judea, of Israel, had the nerve to rebel and undertake a revolt. They were colonized by Rome, same as everybody else, in the whole world, the whole Mediterranean world. But Judea revolted, and for 3 years had a pretty successful revolt against Rome between 67 and 70. And then at the end of that time, Titus and his sons just came in and put the whole thing down at a terrible toll on the land, on the peoples. They burned Jerusalem. They captured many thousands of captives and took them to Rome and paraded them through the streets bound, hands behind their back, in chains, to sort of show off what Rome can do. And then in the end, they killed the people. But these triumphal processions are commemorated still. You can see it on this sculpture that's in the top of this thing called the Arch of Titus that shows the sad, sad procession of the menorah, the candelabra from the temple in Jerusalem, being carried through the streets of Rome, paraded, shown off. And then the other things from Jerusalem that had been taken captive and then were set up in Rome in this new kind of museum or temple that they built called the Temple of Peace. And Rome's notion of peace, the Pax Romana, was peace that's built on military victory. And the Temple of Peace is then where you display the spoils of war. I think all of this is in John's mind. I believe that he might have witnessed the Jewish War. He was perhaps a refugee from Judea that then moved to Asia Minor, to Turkey, as one of the many, many refugees from the war. It's possible, anyway. We certainly think he was Jewish and would have known this whole history in his bones about how terrible Rome's actions were. And indeed, we think that's why he calls Rome Babylon. Because the only other time in history that Jerusalem had been captured and burned was the Babylonian captivity in 587 BC. So John then is drawing a kind of link between Babylon's destruction of Jerusalem in 587 and Rome's destruction of Jerusalem in 70. In fact, this is daring political critique. I mean, he's rather outspoken in his critique of Rome. If you read chapter 18 of Revelation and read it as a critique of Rome, it's pretty strong stuff. He's calling Rome's trade fornication. He goes through this cargo list of Rome's items that have been traded on the Mediterranean Sea that will no longer be traded. I mean, he is foretelling the end of Rome. He's saying this empire that calls itself eternal. And indeed, that was Rome's slogans on their coins, Roma Eterna. They advertise themselves as eternal, omnipotent, almighty, everlasting. And John says, no, these terms don't belong to Rome at all. Rome is not eternal. It's going to end. And who is it who's omnipotent, almighty, everlasting? It's God. And the message of the book of Revelation is to not worship Rome, but rather to worship God alone and the Lamb who is Jesus, the Lamb who has been slain. And these are the ones then to whom John gives the terms of omnipotence and almightiness and holiness and greatness, all the terms that Rome claimed for itself. Rome wanted you to worship it. And John is saying, worship God alone. Don't worship Rome. Chapter 13, you cannot find a more sort of vivid anti-civil religion chapter than Revelation 13 that basically says the beast, which also is Rome, is trying to get people to worship it, and it can even use smoke and mirrors and make magical things happen, talking statues, all of this which we know was the case. They could set up huge statues of emperors, and someone could go up inside of it, and they could make smoke come out in a deep voice, sort of like the Wizard of Oz. Yeah. And in fact, I think the book of Revelation is, in some ways, like the Wizard of Oz, and some say that it's even based on it, that the Emerald City is based on the New Jerusalem vision. I don't know about that. But anyway, you know how when Dorothy and her companions finally get to Oz and they go in to see him, it's this really scary statue with this deep voice, I am Oz, the great and terrible. And they're somewhat terrified. That's how statues in the Roman Empire could work as well. They could terrify people, statues, emperors. But anyway, I think the book of Revelation sort of plays the role of Toto in that scene. Because, you know, it's little Toto, then the dog, who goes off to the side and pulls back the curtain and exposes the fact that Oz is not so great and terrible. It's just this man from Kansas who's pulling levers and doing the voice into a microphone, you know, so to sound really scary. And Revelation is trying to do that for you. It's doing an expose of Rome. It's pulling back the curtain. That's what the word apocalypse means. I'm sorry these magic markers are so here. Well, I'll definitely attend these, but... And then, of course, you don't want to use a permanent marker here. Okay, dry erase. Apocalypse. Here we go. Okay, apo means from, and calypsis means covering. So, you could translate it either as revealing or as uncovering, as pulling back the curtain. And that's what apocalypses do. There were a lot of apocalypses in the ancient world, and what they do is sort of pull back the curtain to reveal another world to you. And I think it's pulling back the curtain to do an expose on Rome and then to reveal to you God's throne room, the almightiness of God, the true one who is to be worshipped, the one before whom we should cast our crowns, not before Rome. I mean, it's definitely, the book of Revelation, I would agree with the Left Behind novels in the sense that this book has a sort of decision theology in it, which, you know, Lutherans are cautious about, we could say. You're supposed to make a choice in Revelation. And the choice you're making is whether to worship God or whether to worship Rome. And the book wants to make you choose God and the Lamb. Even though Rome is enticing and powerful and scary and appealing, it seems to be the only world that there is. John is telling you there is another world. It's God's world. And be a citizen of that city, not a citizen of Rome. I mean, he's appealing to us to make a choice of loyalty and allegiance. But like I say, I don't think the outcome that Revelation sees is that we're going to somehow be snatched off the earth. I think rather the outcome that it sees is that the Roman Empire is going to end with all its injustices, with its slave trade. I mean, one of the reasons I think this book is so important... and was important in the 19th century was that this was the only book in the Bible that had a critique of slavery at a time, you know, when our country was debating whether to continue to allow slavery or not. And we know that in the ancient Roman world, slavery was probably as many as 30% of the population. We don't have the demographics. People disagree on that. But Ephesus, where John is writing to, that's the first city he mentions to, and he probably had lived in Ephesus and then went to the island of Patmos. But Ephesus had become a hub of the Roman slave trade. So he was very conscious of this slaveholding economy and slave trade. And in his cargo list in chapter 18, one of the things he mentions in the cargo that will be no more, in verses 12 and 13 are this cargo list. Cargo of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls, all these things. But at the end of the list in 13, he goes through these 26 items, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and slaves, that is human souls or human bodies. It's variously translated. But here, twice at the end of this list, he's critiquing the slave economy. And this passage is really important. I mean, John is in some ways the most radical of the New Testament authors that we have. He really sees the Roman government as evil and unjust. He says that it's taken the blood of so many people, and he doesn't just mean Christians, but he means everybody, that Rome was a violent and militaristic society. And you see this not just in Christian authors like John, but the Roman historian Tacitus, for example, when he's talking about Rome's conquest of Britain, which was pretty violent under Claudius, Tacitus writes, "They made it a desert and they called it peace." And that's what military conquests do. I mean, they make a desert out of a land. They make it a wasteland, and then they call it peace. That's what Rome had done everywhere. And John sees that as terribly unjust. So he's appealing to you not to be part of this Roman economy, this Roman society, but rather to be a citizen of a different society, a different world. And that's then what he finally unfolds in chapters 21 and 22, which are in some ways my favorite chapters of the Bible. I think we really need this vision of New Jerusalem. Let me just draw you what I see as the plot of the book of Revelation. In chapters 1 to 4, those take place on earth, or 1 to 3. Those are the seven letters to the seven churches. And he diagnoses all their problems. And he's very negative about these churches and their problems. Then in chapter 4, you go up to heaven and you see the heavenly throne room. And from that time on, heaven and earth are both going through the book as a sort of timeline here through the chapters. I know this is kind of artificial. All the songs and stuff take place in heaven. And actually, I should just say that a lot of Lutherans tell me, I've never read the book of Revelation. I don't know anything about it. I don't touch it. Well, you do. Every Sunday when you sing the liturgy, you're singing songs out of Revelation. Worthy is Christ, the Lamb who was slain, whose blood set us free. This is straight out of the book of Revelation. The Hallelujah chorus. He shall reign forever and ever. So many of our songs. Holy. God Almighty. Shall we gather at the river? There's no book of the Bible that has influenced our hymnody and music more than Revelation. You're singing it all the time. You know these songs from Revelation. It's just that those aren't the parts of Revelation that the fundamentalists pick up on. But you're more familiar with Revelation than you realize. It's a beautiful book full of these songs in heaven. I'll say one thing. In chapter 12, this is an interesting one. Satan gets thrown out of heaven. So there's great rejoicing in heaven because Satan gets thrown out. It's interesting that he's up there in the first place. And then chapter 13 and on, Satan is stalking the earth. So things get worse. They get worse and worse. And I think this is John's explanation for why things are so terrible during Rome, is he genuinely believes that Satan is stalking the earth through the Roman Empire and through these emperors. In chapter 20, then, Satan finally gets bound and tied up and thrown down into the Egypt where he's supposed to go. And then one of the most interesting things is that in chapter 21, John says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven, and I saw God. And God makes the declaration that God's dwelling place is now going to be with the people. So it never actually says, I will confess, that it doesn't say that God descends to earth, that heaven descends to earth. But what you can see is that in chapter 4, the throne of God was located up in heaven. And in chapter 22, the throne of God is now located on earth. Let's look at the beginning of chapter 22, because this is one of the most beautiful sections of this New Jerusalem vision. The angel is taking John on a tour of this new city. So then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. So that's where God's throne now is in this amazing city that has come down out of heaven in 21:2 and 21:3. And God has come down with the city. In 21:2, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. So New Jerusalem was located up in heaven, but now it looks like, I think, it comes down to earth. And God says, that's where I'm going to live as well. God says in 21:3, behold, the dwelling of God is with people. God will dwell with them. They shall be his people. God will be with them. So Revelation, in my opinion, ends the opposite of what these Left Behind novels think. I mean, it's not a story of people getting sucked out of their cars and snatched away, of babies being taken away from their parents. The end of the story that we need to be really cognizant of is this amazing descent of God to earth. It's very much like the incarnation. When God says, my dwelling is with people, it's the same Greek word as in the Gospel of John. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us in chapter 1. It's this incarnational idea of God coming to dwell with us. And I think we've got to read Revelation through that ending scene where that is indeed what happens. So what I'm going to try to do, I only have a few minutes now to ask you guys what you think. What I'm going to try to do in this book that I'm going to write called Rapture in Reverse, you know, because if the rapture is this kind of snatching idea, this is what I would call Rapture in Reverse. And I want to read the book of Revelation from the end backwards and look, ask the question sort of what would happen if instead of saying, as LaHaye and Jenkins do, you know, basically I don't care about Earth because I've got another place that I'm going to be snatched to. What would happen if we took that New Jerusalem vision as our starting point of saying we've got a vision of a future where God comes to dwell on earth in the midst of this amazing city with the river of the water of life flowing right through it, with the tree of life on either side, where the gates of the city are open and all are welcome? What if we start with that vision for our future in the life of God as God's people? And then work back from that. Obviously back then through the book of Revelation into the sections of political critique, which, you know, we can ask now that Rome is gone. And in a sense, Revelation has already come true. The Roman Empire did end. You know, what does it mean for us now? I'm not convinced that what it means is that we're to hope for a day when we're to be snatched off the earth and that global politics can just unfold in ever-deepening disasters for the earth and that that's God's will. I find that difficult to accept. So, why don't I ask you, how would you write that? I mean, what would be in such a vision, such a book? How do you counter disaster movies and disaster books, I guess, with a vision of God's future that is compelling, that makes for good reading?
I was just going to say, Margaret Dawn, in her book about Revelation, kind of likens it to hope and suffering. I mean, she kind of confronts the reality, I think, that there is a struggle going on now and likens it to our personal suffering and our personal struggle, and also, I think, from institutional suffering, and that the message of Revelation is that Christ will win, and that's our hope. That's where he puts our hope in. So I don't think she sees it as also kind of a world-denying kind of thing, but a, you know, and not embracing suffering, but kind of reconciling and hope in the midst of struggle and stuff.
And I think that book is going to be reprinted now. I would agree with you. She focuses on the personal most of all. Marva Dawn is a wonderful writer, and on her own certainly struggles with the illness and stuff. I'm interested, though, in what can we do more community-wise.
Right.
I guess one of the words that I want to maybe bring in is the wonderful image of Dr. Martin Luther King, the beloved community. He talks about that we need to build the beloved community is what our society is about. I mean, I think that the individualism of these novels, you know, that we don't have to worry about community building is also troubling, and I want to really try to address that. But how do you make that, you know?
If your end is that God somehow is going to come and dwell among us here on earth, then it would be like between now and then what we have to do is create a home where God is comfortable. So like if we were going to invite a guest into our home, what would we do? You know, I would clean my house and I would have food and I would have, you know, it would be a loving, warm place. So before God's going to come here and dwell among us, we need to create this. Mm-hmm. This world isn't that world yet. So that's what I would think about is the steps between this home and that one, what the difference would be and how to get there as individuals and as communities. How do we make it a welcoming place for God? Because you don't know what God's going to look like when God walks in.
And that's certainly the message of Matthew 25, for example, you know, when the people say, well, when did we see you hungry and feed you and naked and clothe you? Well, when you did it to one of the least of these, you did it to me. So God might well be dwelling.
So God could be anywhere, and until everybody is part of that home that you've created, then you're not going to see God there.
Others? Okay, Roseanne?
I was wondering how you could interweave thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven.
Yeah, I was thinking about that too. That was the Holden theme a few years ago, and you realize we pray that every Sunday, on earth as in heaven. What do these novels do about that? I don't know. Of course that's so important. And Jesus' prayer, I mean, he seems to assume in the prayer Jesus does that the kingdom is coming in heaven. But our prayer needs to be, as Luther says also, that it would come also to us and would come also on earth. And that's what we attend to. Yeah, thank you.
It might be a little frivolous, but to counter the bumper stickers of the 70s that said, during rapture, this car will be without a driver, might be something like, Get the coffee pot ready. God is coming.
Huh. Something about God coming. Okay. Thank you.
I like that interpretation because it also speaks to, there's another element of the fundamentalist interpretation of Revelation, which is to find evidence of the evil in other countries and associate that with symbols in Revelation. And that seems to be a separation theology, that kind of us against them, and we can find evil by reading the Revelations. And this interpretation says that we do need to create one of the terms that also the new interpretation talks about in a very negative way is a new world order. But I want to say we do need to create a new world order.
But it's a beloved community.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, I should say the labeling, the separating into good people and bad people is in the book of Revelation. In that sense, they are faithful to that. It's the aspect of Revelation that I think is most problematic. And we don't necessarily need to follow that of sort of name-calling and sorting people into to good people and evil people. But that is actually there. I can't deny that. It's there. Thank you. Let's see. Over here. Uh-huh.
I think in our culture that there's an incredible burden on all of us as individuals to kind of work out our meaning and kind of work out salvation on our own. I see this huge with college students I work with, and I've experienced too that I have this huge burden to kind of figure it all out. And I think it would be important to lift up indigenous cultures, other cultures that see themselves as part of a cosmology, you know, that they're held in a bigger connectedness that would counter this kind of sense that we all have to work it out on our own. And I think that type of experience in our culture really lends to that black and white reading, you know, in terms of this provides me answers, you know, and tells us what to do. And that type of pressure isn't there in a cosmology where you see yourself as connected and as a part of something larger and whole.
Okay, and that appeal, yeah, I should ask you and others of you who have worked with young people or are yourselves young people, I mean, how do you appeal to, I mean, how do you counter the scare tactics of the fundamentalists that were so compelling for me and for others? I mean, do you actually help young people not be...
I think, to me, that cosmology is a big deal in terms of having the sense of connectedness and that we are held and are a part of things, teaching that type of theology and helping people to feel and know it in their bodies, in the community, things like that. That's operating out of the body instead of just the head and this little black and white theology. That's one thing.
Thanks.
I really think it's important to confront, I don't know what word to use, but to address the fears directly. Because I, you know, as you talk about the fundamentalist perspective and this, these stories in here, I mean, they're afraid. That's what I hear more. You know, we were all sitting here laughing, and I was laughing too. But, you know, and part of that laughter is, oh, those silly people, you know, how they look at it. But really, it's scary. People are afraid.
And afraid of what?
We live in a very dangerous, scary world. Uh-huh. We have tools of destruction. We have the ability to destroy it all. We do. I mean, the apocalypse is potentially around the corner. We do have the capacity to destroy ourselves. That's not a fantasy. And we're in this, particularly in the American culture, where we have our fingers on the buttons. Mm-hmm. You know, and we have that power, but we don't feel
out of control.
We feel out of control. So, you know, it's part of that. My current thing is empathy for those others that I like to look at as silly, stupid, evil, whatever I might put on to separate myself from them, to recognize they are really afraid. And because I, you know, for me as a young adult, you know, I remember the fear that I came to when I realized I'm an adult. Mm-hmm. I'm not a kid. Nobody's going to take care of me except for me, you know. And, I mean, that was pretty darn scary. I really freaked out for a couple of years facing that one. And I think that, you know, you are not alone is one of the ways of addressing that. I mean, just basically getting that clear. And that's part of that is those kind of cosmologies. But also it's validating the fear. Yes, it is scary. And I mean, you've got to start there.
Uh-huh. Let me just say, because I know others of you have hands, and I'm happy to talk more, but the bell's going to ring soon for coffee break, and that is the end. And thank you for that about fears. The important scripture text, I think, that also responds to this, because part of what this system does, the Left Behind system, is give you a set of answers that does seem to answer. It gives you a system that seems to make sense of it all.
That's right.
Yet I think Jesus himself tells us not to do that. I just want to point to a couple of Bible verses in Acts 1, 6 and following. After the ascension, or just before, the disciples say, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom?" Jesus said to them, "It is not for you to know the times or the seasons which the Father has fixed by his own authority." And same thing in the Gospel of Matthew. Jesus even says, "Not even the Son of Man knows when the time is." We are not supposed to sit there and calculate and try to figure out. So I would also say that if it seems to be a system of answers that addresses our fears, but it depends on our trying to figure out, you know, is the end time happening now? That's not biblical. And much as it's comforting to think you've got the answers and the timetable, Jesus specifically tells the disciples that's not what you are to be about. Rather, and after Jesus is gone, the angel says, you know, "People of Galilee, why do you stand looking up into heaven? You know, go out and be my disciples." As you say, make a home. I mean, do the work of God on earth, being faithful disciples, knowing that an end will come, surely will come. But it's not for us to figure it out when it is. Okay, thanks, everybody. The bell has rung.